Hi. Thank you for the kind invitations. This workshop is quite unique. You don't find very often a group of academics that are looking into the future of their, not their own discipline, but in their own infrastructure. And it's rare enough so that it should be pointed out. What I'm going to talk about is I'd say that it's a bit like my own story, because I think it illustrates how can research be done in various ways outside academic settings. I will tell you about the experiments I've been doing with the creation of open laboratories and open research programs. And I use this title, Exploring the Dark Matter of Science, as I found it would be a nice fit to this institute. And the goal here is really to, we don't know yet everything about science, how science is structured, how science is growing, or what science is going to become. And there is clearly something unknown that we need to could call dark matter, that probably actually reflects the large majority of what is unknown and what could be done. And not only about knowledge, but also about who can contribute to science. Right now, the number of researchers in the world is very small. It's a few millions for the number of billions people we are. When we have a large number of people that have education and somehow would like to participate to a more high-end research purposes. And so I like the fact that that's what motivated me to go outside academia. It's that why should we need academia as a framework to do research? Has it been always there? Is there other ways? So that's a basic question. So the beginning itself, my academic career was in synthetic biology. It's not me on the picture, but I like this one. Here you have a couple of students that have in their hand two flasks with something that glows in the dark. This is not a kind of new LED. This is biology. This is bioluminescence. It's engineered bioluminescence. It's bacteria that got ability to produce light after genetic manipulation. That kind of thing would have taken probably two PhDs 20 years ago to make it happen. But nowadays, a couple of students, undergrad, can do that in a matter of a few weeks. Synthetic biology has completely changed the way we approach life as a complex object. Now we see it as a kit almost. It has high modularity. And somehow we see it not as a weird subject, but as something that could become a true technology, which is already the case. You've seen that picture before in the workshop, because it reflects very well how fast biotechnology has been changing and how it reflects a revolution, a hidden revolution. Because most of the people didn't know about that until very recently. But it's been going on for the last 15 years. And what's the most impressive is really that how, in a matter of 2 years, you get 3 to 4 order of magnitude decrease of accessibility, of availability in terms of price. Imagine you want something that costs $100,000 or euros. You wait 2 years, it costs only $100 or $10. That's the kind of transformation that happened. So it completely opened the possibilities how to use biology. And this was a sequencing center 15 years ago. As you can see, big machines, very complex. You need technicians to run them. They use a lot of reagents, consumables. They're not very precise. They're very expensive. They break. And 15 years after, that's what is a gene sequencer. And so it not only became smaller, more efficient, cheaper, but it also became much simpler. And so in that perspective, it's not only a technological revolution, it's also a sociological revolution, because you can put the technology in much more hands. And that's kind of the thing that happened some decades ago with computers. I use this picture because it speaks to everyone, but is, you know, in the 70s, computers were big machines, very expensive, that were used only in high-end laboratories or big companies like IBM. Very few people knew how to use computers. However, during the same time, computer logic were taught to students in universities. And at the same time, the price of components decreased a lot also. That was enough to enable students to come together and create their own computer. It was cheap enough. And they didn't do it in their own lab. They didn't have. They did it in their own garage. Not using the logic at the moment, but their own vision of what a computer should do. And that kickstart the personal computer industry in some ways. And you know, if in the 20th century, people would somehow try to hack computers and take it for themselves, in the 21st century, it's happening. The same is happening for biology. And again, it's happening somehow in garages. Because laboratories are closed. You cannot enter laboratories or do experiments or be part of this great intellectual dynamic if you're not part, if you don't have an academic title. It's very hard. So it's, some people don't look at that and they will still gather and do experiments. And this energy is fabulous. It really sometimes make you think that you can really be a pioneer if you want. At the same time, we know that academia is in big crisis, not only about reproducibility, but also about career. And this is, for example, the age distribution of independent investigators receiving NIH grants. And as you can see, it doesn't really go in the right direction. In the 80s, you could be 40 years old, you will have a great chance of getting such grant. Basically give you access to whatever research you want to do. I also have the data for 2012, and it's a bit worse than 20 doses. But what's interesting here is not necessarily the average age only that follows somehow the baby boomers. It's the area, the surface below the curve, before 35 years old, or even before 30, if you want. In the 80s, you will have some fair chance, actually, being very young to get such an award, such a grant. But nowadays, it's close to zero. And that's kind of shocking when you know that, for example, two of the most famous scientists in the world, Einstein and Darwin, they made their main discoveries before the age of 30. It seems that somehow institutions are not able to deal with special talents or special missions. You have to follow the line. You have to follow the highway. And that's kind of disturbing. So how do we find, again, this freedom of being curious and starting any ideas that comes through your mind? So that's something that really motivated me. I was myself a young researcher, was starting my PhD in synthetic biology. I had the chance to co-found the laboratory where I would do my PhD. So it put me in a position where I was basically managing the laboratory where I was doing my PhD. But even in my own lab, I was not able to do whatever I wanted or to work with whoever I wanted. So I thought that this was many years ago. This was almost 10 years ago. I'm not going to see how moving forward in my career would make this even better. So let's make an experiment. And let's see if we, if laboratory should look like academia at all. What is a laboratory in the 21st century? What does it mean to do to do research? Nobody knows, so let's make an experiment. Let's open a laboratory where nobody, everybody can come and work on whatever they want, however they want, and with whoever they want. But when you are 25 years old, it's hard already to create your own lab when you're a researcher. So why are you going to build a lab when you're 25 years old? well, you do it with what you have. So I joined a squad in the suburb of Paris where artists were using for their workshop. And there, in a matter of a few months, with a community that I gathered this time, we built a biotech laboratory using refurbished lab equipment that we got from lab garbages. It looked like that at the beginning. Funny enough, this lab became more equipped than my own PhD lab for €0. And that was already something very very amazing for me. When you're told that research doesn't have enough resources to do what you want, at some point it's just a question of designing the right system to share resources. And we invited the community, people, anybody could come. So I was expecting mostly biologists. But what happened is actually biologists were in minority. We got a lot of engineers in various disciplines, but also designers, artists, sociologists, citizens in general. And they were all coming because they wanted to do biology and they never could before. So we got at some point this amazing mix of skills, and we could start any project because we had everything on our hand. So we worked on various prototypes. We did about 15 different projects.
I just go back a slide. I mean, it's this whole story is totally amazing to me, right? And I mean, I just imagine, say there was an abandoned building in Waterloo, right? I wouldn't even know where to be. Did you begin with friends? Did you show up there and recruit people? I mean, I just don't even know.
Okay.
Once it's like this, I can see where it happens. But yeah. I don't know how you go from
So basically, it took me 1 year. I went to many places to tell about that plan I wanted to do and to recruit people. A lot of people will say, "That's great. I want to be part of it. Tell me when it's done." But the amount of people that we'll be able to say, "I really want to be part of it. I want to help you from the start," are very rare. So it took me about a year. I was doing this during my PhD. I was not doing this full time, obviously.
Can I ask one more question? How old were these people, and what disciplines or communities were they from?
They were, I would say, perhaps probably the youngest. They were between 23 and 45, 50 years old. So during 3 years, we did about 15 different projects with 50 different collaborators, working on chip genetic diagnosis tests to test what you have in your food, for example, or to understand what you have in your garden. It's very hard actually to ask the question, what is this species? What kind of meat? What kind of animals do I have in my plate? It's very strange to say this at the age of Wikipedia, where you have on the internet you have access to so many informations, but immediate information that you have in front of you is something that is much harder. You get it more and more for physical and chemical properties like the quality of air, but for biological information it's much harder. So we did some what we called, for example, the quick and dirty DNA barcoding. It's a method that for €5 you can test what you have in your food, and know if you have any of the 10 different species that we have pre-programmed in the thing. We had some surprises. And we work on various kind of biomaterials. We created, for example, some biodegradable electronics. We made an ink that you can grow yourself using bacteria. That actually became a much serious project afterwards. It became a startup. It's called PD. Now it runs with millions of budget and 15 people full time in France, and they produce natural dyes for the industry using fermentation to replace all the petrochemical dyes. We worked also on various kind of lab equipment, and for example, we even got money from NASA to make an open source low cost bioreactor. Bioreactors are a very useful machine to manipulate the environment to grow microorganisms, make molecules, biomolecules, or biomaterials, even to do to degrade waste, organic waste. But those machines are very expensive, usually at least $15,000 or euros, and they're always closed source. So if we really want to imagine a future where biology much you know, becomes more easy to do, especially where we can really integrate ourselves as humanity with nature. You know, it seems macroorganisms are kind of a nice interface for that. So we need, you know, better bioreactors and much cheaper one. And we wrote a proposal to NASA for a call they were making, making low-cost tools for space exploration. And we got it. NASA didn't know that we were in a squat, but they looked at the proposal. It was relevant enough for them. So that was interesting, because at some point you realize, that this initiative that is completely out of the normal framework is actually legitimate enough to produce, to ask NASA for money, and producing, 15 projects, some of them becoming startups with 50 different collaborators, all volunteers, right? They're euro, so we don't pay rent, electricity, or salaries, and we were producing more potentially research or innovation than a normal size lab in France. So that became actually interesting at that point. And at the end of my PhD, I asked myself, what should I do? Should I continue my academic career? Because I love what I did during my PhD, so then I had plenty of opportunities. Or should I give a chance to this small embryo of laboratory? Because if I leave it, it's going to crash. I was the main person providing energy here. And so I told myself, I'm going to give 1 year full time. And see what's happening. And with the goal of creating a sustainable model for this lab and say that maybe this is the seed for a model as an alternative for the academic model. In 2014, this is where we were, the red point. And with the help of especially the mayor of Paris that got us a grant, I convinced the mayor of Paris to help us. A biohacker space. It was quite a funny meeting. We moved right in the center of Paris. We are Rue Saint-Denis in the second quarter. You cannot be more central than that almost. And we came from this to this in 800 square meters. So it looks like a small institute almost, and we provide lab facilities, people can work. It's like you enable people to do any kind of projects. The goal is to explore, and you can be an artist, you don't have to be a researcher, you can be an entrepreneur. The goal is just to provide a niche for people that don't have access to a lab academic environment or to a lab environment at all. So that's it for Lab Payas. The point is, in parallel of that, there is a huge transformation in our society right now. We live in the age of communities. And it's like you can feel an amazing power. It's not new, right? There's been communities all the time, but with digital technologies, their capacity of being to mobilize themselves and act together has been much more important and powerful. And you see now true innovations being born out of those communities. And you probably know about Fab Labs. There are thousands of Fab Labs now in the world, and so it's mostly for electronics and robotics. But you can do so many things with this. And now biology is joining the game. New models for doing biological projects is one of them is iGEM. iGEM is an amazing competition. It exists for almost 15 years now. And what they do is they invite students to come together, create a team, and propose a synthetic biology project. So it's only open to students. And students have 6 months to work in the lab, or to get resources, to find an ID, get in the lab, make a prototype, and present it at the end in front of a jury. It started with a few dozens of students. Now it's every year it's more than 6,000 students from all over the world that participate. From 55 different countries, more than 300 teams, I think it was 315 teams last year. And I was myself, I co-founded the first French team in 2007 and completely changed my life because for the first time I got to work on a project of mine, you know, that was born with myself. I was not answering the call of a more senior person than me. It was truly interdisciplinary, where biologists, mathematicians, physicists, engineers, medical students or pharmacists, and we truly enjoyed that. And in fact, we won that year in 2007, and we had beaten MIT, Harvard, Oxford, etc. Just being actually a small group of people from Paris with no institutional affiliation. So there are those examples, and then you ask the question, how can this actually somehow help science become more inclusive, more open, more transparent, more team oriented? And then you see also this kind of things, why scientists need to use pirated website to do their work. It's like kind of crazy when you think about it. So at that point, when I was running La Payas, we had this nice physical space in the center of Paris. But then you ask the question, what's next? And that was, to be able to enjoy La Payas, you need to be in Paris. You need to be able to find the time and dedicate it to be part of this group in this physical place. And do it. That's a very small amount of people. And I was fascinated by how makers and hackers in the world were collaborating with each other. You got a problem. You're working on a problem that is of common interest. You're stuck. You can just ask around, and most probably people were going to help you for free because it's important. And they will do it fast, efficiently. It's this kind of dynamic. Where money is not involved, I couldn't find it even in science, at least in the academic world, because at the end, everything is related to grants. If you want to prototype an idea, test something, I don't know if we have the time, I need to ask for this, for that, can we ask a grant, and it's better. So it's like we lost somehow this ability to prototype or test new ideas very fast.
A couple of financial questions. So the lot I asked, they have jobs. Where do they get the money to buy their groceries and pay their rent? Is this a full-time thing or just a hobby?
Everybody has a different business model. We don't pay anybody. So they have to figure it out. So in the sense that some of them, are entrepreneurs, and so they invest in themselves. This is going to spend 6 months, a year, actually create a prototype. Some others touch the... the retirement, that they're retired, or some other are just getting the unemployment rate. Some other are students, and they get actually help from their university to do a project. Some of them are part-time freelancers, for example, or artists. So there are so many models, just that we don't want to impose any models on anyone. That was the goal.
Where does the money come from to buy stuff? Like, it's all very well to have equipment donated.
So La Payas provides
disposables and gloves and the agar and all.
La Payas provides all the basic stuff.
But so where does the money come from?
So our business model. So I didn't want to spend too much time on this because I have so many slides afterwards. I need to speak about Drago. Our business model is based on mainly on private partnerships, but I prefer actually to enter the details afterwards if you agree. But we provide most of the stuff to the residents, and if they need something specific, they have to figure out how to get it. But we have many friends, and they like actually what we do, so they provide us for free with many things. So then the point was, how can we get this kind of model where if you're working on something important, then you can just ask the community to work on it and figure out like new approaches, being surprised, giving the chance for people that are outside the usual research realm to do something. And also how do you create what could be the environment of a research institution like this one, where if you enter with your idea, find everything necessary. You find facilities, you find faculties, people that have experience in that subject, so they can orient you, they can discuss with you. You don't have to figure out everything for yourself, because you have this infrastructure. So how can you create such an infrastructure that make it easy for anybody to have an idea or have at least a skill to apply it and move forward on that idea? But not doing it in a physical space, inviting people in a distributed manner. And that was the idea behind Epidemium. So Epidemium is a research program where what we will do is we will ask communities to work on a complex subject, here better understanding cancer using big data. And but anybody could participate. They wouldn't be paid for that. But in exchange, we'll provide them with any kind of resources they would need to work on their project. We did that with Roche as a partner, and you will see even for Roche it was quite disruptive, because everything is based on open data and everything that is produced is open source. There is no exclusivity for partners. Everything is documented, so it's really like fully open. You need to be collaborative and transdisciplinary, because you don't have this kind of skills in the same brain, data science and medical knowledge. And then, as I told you, we get independence in the sense that everything that is produced doesn't belong to anybody, it belongs to the world. And it's the idea is like to make this program work as a platform. We provided the data, we created actually for this occasion the first open data platform for cancer. Open data resources regarding cancer, they were spread all over. It was very actually hard to find where to find this data. So we got more than 20,000 data sets that we gather in one central place with explanation about their how you to use them, their licenses, etc. We provided them with tools and software. We had servers to do computations. And also we had network an ecosystem. We created two committees, one scientific one, and an ethical one. And we got some of the best researchers or actors within the health ecosystem or in the data science ecosystem to come and help and mentor the participant. We even got Cédric Villani, for example, who is a Fields medalist, to actually be there and help and answer questions. He actually loved it. So the kind of expected outcome were that, how can we also fuel researchers with tools, but that's not the only goal. It's like, sometimes people would just want to do their own project, bring healthcare professional solutions or give patients answers, doing kind of analysis, but creating project that may not actually exist in a normal setting. We created a network of supporting partners. Jogo created the platform for this program. At the time, it was in both institutions. And so we got academic institutions, we got industrials, we got startups, nonprofit organizations, patients associations. So the idea was to bring all the stakeholders together. So for the first edition, there was 4 challenges. At the end, we mobilized more than 300 people just in the region of Paris. About two-thirds of those were professionals, and a third were students. At the end, there was more than 3,600 contributions on the wiki. And here you can see, it's not very, but basically you have the different projects, and here are your different skills. And you can see how actually it needs like different matches to be able to make them happen. What's interesting is, like, to give you an example, one of the best projects was done by data scientists working in a bank. They, those kind of profile, they're very good at what they're doing, and we could say they don't have time actually to look at research. They don't have time to think about working on a. On an open project, especially complex as this one, because they don't have any knowledge. So, what's the point? The cost is too high. But in fact, there are many things that those people can do because they have micro skills that could be very useful. And in fact, what they did is they created a beautiful software to do data management and data visualization that even a child could use. And they, you know, that kind of thing would cost probably $100,000 or $200,000 to make. But they did it for free. It's completely open source. For them, they did it on their free time. But at some point, they were having so much fun that their company agreed that they would be able to spend more time on it. Because it was beneficial for them individually. So here we had created an environment where it became easy for them to go back and be useful to science or research in some sense, or here more specifically to public health. So that's kind of important. It's like, how can we bring back also skills or bring energy back to science and research outside the people working in academia? Another project was done by three women. The youngest was 23 years old, and the oldest was 92 years old. And the 92 years old woman, Marthe Gauthier, she's really incredible. She obviously retired. She used to be a researcher. She's actually the co-discoverer of the Down syndrome. She couldn't do research for decades. Marthe Gauthier.
I think I wrote a Wikipedia page about her.
Maybe. But she couldn't do research for decades, right?
She got her credit stolen for her discovery.
I don't know, maybe. But there, actually, she could join a team of much younger people and do research again. In fact, she actually worked on the project around how to use Twitter data for doing epidemiology of cancer. And so that's the kind of thing that could never happen in a normal setting. You know? Another project was done by mobilizing more than 200 individuals to go and find all the open data around the world that could help do epidemiology of cancer. That's a very hard job. You have to, it takes a lot of time. And you have somehow to be synchronized in some so that at the end you get something that makes sense. You know, can treat the data correctly. That's the kind of thing that, again, you cannot do in a normal lab. So there are so many projects that, even though they will not be able to compete with a team of specialists that have been doing this for 10 years, again, what they're doing here actually is useful anyway. And stuff that would be actually hard to do in a normal lab. So that was enough, actually, for me to spark this idea that, again, what's the future of this? Like, should we scale that? Like, how do we scale this? Like, if we mobilize 300 people just in the first edition in the region of Paris, then it means that probably in a few years we'll be able to mobilize dozens of thousands of people on a more global scale, but that's fantastic when you think about it, but then how do you manage that? How do you synchronize that much people together? We didn't have the answer. So we started actually to work around that, and in fact, we there was a big trend around open science and participatory science. Some of those who have been explained before, like the universe. And so the point is that it seems that we could imagine a world where some of the largest projects could be done by communities, not only by public institutions or big private companies. Communities have a place, except that they don't have yet the right tools and environment to be structured enough to be able to focus on one thing and be efficient. To give you some perspective, CNRS is the largest research institution in France. It's one of the largest actually in the world with almost 32,000 faculties. 32,000 faculties, that sounds a lot and small at the same time. I think that probably in a couple of years, we could actually get much more than this on Juggle, for example, on a platform. I didn't talk about Juggle yet, but the point is, we could mobilize that kind of number of people just on cancer itself around the world. and probably being able to do stuff that these kind of laboratories would never be able to do again. And then you find, I found this fascinating. We have 7 billion people in the world. About 1 billion of them have some kind of higher education. There's about 8 million active researchers in the world. A lot of platforms ask the question about how to make sense and research better, but they are all applied to academics only. And they just forget about this dark matter of science. You find, there is an, again, this is about the trend. Here, for example, is the Neuroscience Institute of Montreal. They are completely, they embraced open science. They are completely open. Everything they produce, they publish in a matter of days in the open. And they use as the platform F1000. Okay. Then you have Janelia that is a specialist of microscopy, and they create their own system and devices, and again, they put it in the open using open hardware licenses. You get more and more projects being funded through crowdfunding without the kind of data. You have more and more health initiatives being done using open source knowledge, open source tools, and releasing everything in the open again, open scene, open source drug discovery, open source malaria. So at some point you realize that if you follow that trend, we'll get to a point where there will be many and many initiatives that have to rely on communities. And in fact, communities have this power to bring a lot of things to research and scientists in general, but not only. Except that research institutions and researchers are completely helpless in front of communities. They don't know how to work with them, and because it's a blurry thing, you cannot, you know, it's not an institution, you cannot put a name on it often. So then the whole idea is that how can you create a research institute or a development institute if you want to do innovation, not only producing scientific knowledge, that is really adapted to this era of communities. That's the idea behind Just One Giant Lab, where, you know. To be able to do that, let's not build one more physical space. Let's build a research institute that works as a platform and work with existing laboratories, work with existing communities or initiatives around the world, and let's, you know, synchronize with each other. Let's create a value chain where everybody wins something at doing what they do. You will find, again, the same kind of value that we tested with Epidemium, being open, inclusive. Just, you know, talking about inclusiveness, just let's think about, we were talking about it yesterday with some people, think about this crisis of refugees in Europe especially. How many of them have actually great education, had great jobs where they were living, but actually are not able to apply that intellect anymore? Well, you know, being able to bring them back to be able to play a role and, you know, and be wonder with their brain about nature and knowledge, or be useful because they want to invent something that is useful for their own community, is very important. And so far, nothing enabled that. So then, what is the main problem that Drago is trying to solve here is, you know, there are a lot of people have great ideas, but it's very hard actually for them to find the right resources. You know, resources mean like everything. Even researchers, you have to follow processes. And so you adapt your research cycle to those processes, basically. So how can we create new kind of processes, new kind of transaction systems, where you're not talking about money anymore, but you exchange, you know, mentorship, creativity, time, data, validation, recognition, resources, assistance, many things. And you know, motivations, incentives would differ if you're a researcher or students or the NGO or public institutions or somebody that is looking for a job, etc. So it's like we should be able to somehow use this kind of energy and transform this into how can they use that motivation to produce knowledge or produce something important for solving an important problem. And so to make this happen, we basically work on four pillars: the science of science, because at the end, we need to understand how science is done, so how to better synchronize people, how to better characterize collaboration. We've done some work on this. I'm not going to talk about it. It's a different subject. But we studied various ecosystems, iGEM especially, and we had, we're going to publish this in the next few months. But we've done that mostly with the Network Science Institute in Boston. And we had some very interesting findings, and that was motivating enough for us to think that, yes, it is possible to create some kind of hybrid creative intelligence where artificial intelligence can understand the state of collaboration within a group or the health of collaboration within a group and help in function of or not, or bring the state of that group towards a more efficient position. A modular and open platform is very important because we don't want to reinvent the wheel. There are so many things. There is a diversity of tools. Not one tool is good for everyone. So according to each project, people should be able to create their own ecosystem of tools. And then the others have to follow on that project specifically. So you need to be modular and create just an upper layer an API, and using APIs to connect all the tools. That's how basically the juggle is working. Platform is completely open. It's run by a nonprofit organization. The goal is to federate the kind of initiative that we have around the world. Because one thing that I've experienced with La Payasse and all those fab labs and open laboratories is even if you tell that you open at some point, if you don't have the right critical mass, I've seen so many people trying to do their own thing on their own side. They spend a lot of energy doing this with a lot of patience. At the end, almost nobody actually succeeded because, they couldn't get to the end. They got tired. It takes a lot of effort and time, much more than you think actually, to get to a point where it's self-sustainable. And so that's why it's important actually to bring as much people as possible together, agreeing on a specific path. Then a research institute as a service. How do you create a platform, a space where you get actually access to tools that are necessary for you to do your research in a distributed way. So maybe it's not going to be adapted to all research projects, but certainly there will be a lot of existing ones and probably a lot of new ones that will be interested in using this kind of approach. And finally, Juggle is a program of Juggle, meaning that this is a co-development. Meaning that we are not developing a product that we want to sell to people. This is something that is being co-developed and by users, with the users. That is why when we're going to release the beta in May, there will be a beta committee will invite people that are motivated enough to join us and really work with us to identify the right features, the right use, like user interface or use cases to improve this initiative altogether. So, and finally, here is just to give you an idea of how the logic will work. On Juggle, you have two layers. You have one layer that is basically the passive platform you can use by yourself with your own energy and passion. But then we have programs too. Programs are like Epidemia. One of the missions of Juggle is to create open research programs. With a set of partners, we identify a single program that we want to boost. And we get resources from those partners, and we distribute those resources in a much larger and diversified landscape of actors. And that's a very important mission for us because we think that then it will enable much more people, not only the ones that are already doing research, be able to join in. And leaders for that are very important because they guide the project. They provide long-term vision and responsibility to get the project to some place. Leaders can be researchers like yourself, they can be NGOs, they can be social entrepreneurs. It can be quite diverse. And then what you want is, we call them druggers, but the point is you want a lot of people wants to contribute to a project without having a leadership position. They are students, they are professionals, like the one that participated in Epidemium. They are patients, citizens, amateurs. So far, it's actually extremely hard to bring those two people together. in teams. You know, we were talking about the transaction cost. It's all about that. So one of the goals of Drogo is to decrease that transaction cost as much as possible using you know, the right design of, for the framework. But to make this happen, you need resources. And that comes from enablers. Those are basically institutions, organizations that say, OK, I already fund research, or I want to have an impact on that problem. Instead of just working with the more traditional institutions or actors, I'm going to use Drogo as an interface to to diversify the kind of actors that are touched by my help.
Come on, there's a lot of stuff here. There's a question that's been on my mind for the last half hour, so let me ask you. I can only mentor, if I have graduate students, I can probably mentor 5 of them. It's a very intensive process.
That's right.
If I have 30 graduate students, I'm a bad advisor. I just can't. Somehow it seems like you've solved that problem, that people are able to get mentorship and training. Somehow, like, the multiplier effect has kicked in for you, right? It's not sort of 1 to 5. How did you break that? I mean, how did you break that problem?
So, again, nobody is forcing anybody actually to do that. The point is, there are some project or tasks, for example, that are very well applied, where you don't need that much mentorship, at least some guidance. You know, so you orient, you provide orientation to the people that are going to come to your help, for example, for the project. So the goal is not to, you could imagine recruiting your own graduate students through this, through Drogo, in the future. Why not? But the point is, sometimes if you want to work on a specific kind of data set, or if you want to get some data, or to launch a new collaboration, the idea would that you probably won't be alone doing it. Sometimes you may actually create new kind of collaborations, and that Drogo will be able to do that. So it's, again, the point to say that we don't have the answers. The goal is to experiment and to test the limits, to test reality. It may completely fail. But I think we are at the right moment to do that. And not everybody is going to be willing to do it, because they will prefer actually to continue their own career, and that's all right. But if in some of you, I guess some people in that room too, feel that they bear responsibility to move forward with this discussion, then they can test this kind of approach too.
I guess it's a simple question, right? So the number of scientists, researchers that UBC can produce, right? It's really rate limited by the number of faculty, right? Even if you poured all the money you wanted into UBC, there would still be, if you didn't increase the number of trained faculty and postdocs within that system, you couldn't get more students out the other. You couldn't get more researchers out the
other. That's right.
Somehow you guys have done this.
Well,
you solved this problem.
Because there's a say, somebody said this, it just struck home. Researchers often take on summer students, undergraduates or upper level undergraduates, to work in their lab for a summer. And this quote was, a really good summer student is one that doesn't cost you a month's work. So it's really very intensive. And I'm wondering if, in fact, the problem isn't, when you said, almost no projects actually succeed, or almost no people who come in with some goal come out having done what they meant to do. And I'm wondering if there's a relationship here, that one of the month's work, or the many, many months of work for a graduate student, is keeping them on track, helping them problem solve, getting them to the point where they succeed, where the success rate is not 100%, but it's 80-90%.
We have a duty as an advisor. We have a duty to make sure that our graduate students have a very high chance of succeeding.
Right.
You guys are highly tolerant of failing.
So
maybe that's one of the secrets.
You have two kind of people. You have the people that wants to do academic career. Those are the graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people that don't care about that, but still wants to help. So you don't have to provide the same amount of mentoring to them. But still, it's...
But then maybe
science, they don't care if they fail?
Hmm?
They don't, you don't have to provide so much mentoring because you don't really care if they fail?
I would not say that. The point is to find the right trade-off. Is that what we've seen so far is we're not talking about people that necessarily have to learn everything. You're not going to teach to people that know nothing about your subject. There are some people that are very good at what they're doing. They are just completely disconnected to the world of research. And sometimes, you know, they are very autonomous, most of the time, actually, that we've seen. So it's more like, you know, to advance. Again, it's like we develop projects in ways that are very adapted to the current design of academia. So here is, if you provide a new infrastructure, how can we develop projects in different ways? Maybe new kind of projects. So it's, you know, and maybe that's not going to adapt to what you're doing.
No. I mean, it's part of what you're saying, sort of hidden in here, is a very different kind of science, right? It's not going to look like the kind of science that comes out of a standard academic training.
Right.
It may be more connected to industry, perhaps. It may be more practical.
Not necessarily. It's, you know, at the end, it could be completely connected to how people work already with archive or fast publication. It's at the end, yes, you will probably see more at the beginning people that look for doing apply stuff, but because it appeals to them faster. They're already out of this academic logic. But the point is that I strongly believe that this is also possible to using this kind of model to produce knowledge. And to do actually interesting experiments, to reproduce experiments, to provide incentive for reproduction of experiments, for example.
So what would be, actually, one thing you haven't shown us here. Yeah.
Kind of really late, it's kind of
yeah, I know, but we're also here, we've gone all the way here. This is a really great,
close to finishing, or
yeah, I have, I think, 3 or 4 more slides.
So maybe we can set up the next speaker while you talk, or I don't know how.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the great examples. This is the really explicit examples, but one of the few we've had, which is actually this happening. What would be an example of a project that came out, like an actual research project that came out from one of the jugglers or La Palace that, you know, wasn't sort of brought about by a standard kind of academic model? Could you give us an example?
So one of the projects that is being done in Epidemium is right now being written for publication. And it's I'm not myself like probably be able to explain it because it's really stuff that I don't know much scientifically speaking. But it's one of the the mentor of the project is a researcher himself, and it's connected to how to do distributed clinical trials, So it's how to use, for example, stuff like blockchain for doing this. So at the end, it's we're not yet at the level of you can find in academia, but we started 2 years ago, and I think that already the level we get with that much people and resources is quite promising. I bet that some people will be much smarter than us to think about how to use also this kind of approach for themselves. It will motivate them to say, finally, I can do this way. No, do it this way, not the way I've been asked to do. So it's like also being surprised, not planning too much for the future. I will not make a demo right now because we don't have time, but I'd like to take the time later for the ones that are interested, but I can reshow you what we have already. We have basic stuff. So here, for example, are the 4 different tools that we have incorporated so far. Chat, Git, Drive, Wiki, and this is an example of Epidemium because we have not released yet the full juggle version. A page for project where you find basic stuff like kind of skills necessary for the project, a timeline. For the project with other tasks or when it's due, the full description of the project, kind of activity member that you have here, can like give me a task or join a team. We brought together existing platforms that are already also open source, but you know, we can, using APIs, bring any kind of platform, even if they're not open source, like Slack, for example. And everything is connected, so you don't have to log in every time to all those platforms. You use a single Dragon login for that.
You'd be okay to present this at 1:30, maybe, because we have a tutorial session.
And we use also this to provide an activity feed, and then also to build a recommendation system based on the activity that you have on those different platforms. The goal, and one of the things we're doing, especially with the Network Science Institute, is we're building an engine to better understand the needs of users and to understand the dynamic of collaboration. So this is like state-of-the-art work with the Network Science Institute. And one thing is we lack data. And one goal of, because those kind of data are very difficult to get, like quality data for measuring those kind of dynamics. IDEM was one of the great examples we could find. Still, it's limited, but about you know, a few dozens of thousands of people. But with Joggle, we could actually imagine getting much more data than that and train better actually system for better synchronization in the future. So I'm not going to answer details. This is a timeline. We released Joggle beta in May. We have this beta period until November, where we recruit, if you want to join, initiatives or projects, so people that want to co-build Joggle with us. We plan to launch some of the first programs in November 2. And here is the team. Thank you very much. So Mark is the one that mainly work on the network science, the science of science approach, also with Leo. Olivier and Mehdi are the boss, were very, heavily involved in the creation of Epidemium. And Bodo he has joined us lately in the last 6 months. And he comes from the social impact entrepreneurship world. And she's mainly been using technology to help social workers. So that opportunity also to bring technology and an R&D approach to social innovation for that. All right.